in People versus Donis.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Robert Marquez, registration number 19577, representing the defendant appellant David Donis. And if I could request to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
I will remind you when it comes up. If I don't, you'll see a yellow light.
Thank you, Judge. This is an appeal from a judgment of conviction entered against Mr. Donis following a jury trial, which he was found guilty on numerous felonies, the most serious of which was first-degree kidnapping, first-degree burglary, robbery, second-degree assault, and I believe menacing. And the complaining witness in this case was Mr. Donis's former landlord, a man by the name of David Bullock. And Mr. Donis was also in the process of purchasing a Ford Explorer, I believe it was, from Mr. Bullock. And we've raised five issues in our brief. I want to focus on three of those, and I'd rely on the arguments set out in the brief on the other two issues. The two that I'm going to rely on in the brief are the question of whether the trial court erred in allowing Mr. McKinney, David McKinney, to testify where there was an alleged discovery violation. I believe that's argument B in the brief. And the other issue that I would rely on in the brief is the issue of whether Mr. Donis was denied a timely preliminary hearing. That's issue E. So I want to focus on the other three. And of course, if there are any questions by any of the panel members, I'd be happy to take those other two issues. But the first issue I wanted to talk about was the issue of the denial of Mr. Donis's right to proceed pro se in this case. And I want to start off by conceding that early on in this case, Mr. Donis's behavior in the courtroom left a great deal to be desired. And I'm talking primarily about what happened at his preliminary hearing. I think that was on April 30th and May 4th, May 8th, and then again at his arraignment on June 6th. And that's pretty early in the proceedings. That was in 2007. And what had happened at that stage is Mr. Donis's court-appointed attorney and his prior private attorney were suggesting that a competency evaluation might be in order. And this set Mr. Donis off because he felt very strongly that he was competent to proceed. And this created serious issues of mistrust between Mr. Donis and his attorneys. And that was a big factor in the bad behavior, for lack of a better term for it, early on in this case. Mr. Donis went for the competency evaluation that was done in the summer of 2007. Apparently, the report came back that he was competent because the trial judge did not stay the proceedings. By September, I think it was the end of September 2007, Mr. Donis wanted to proceed pro se. The judge was apparently satisfied that Mr. Donis's behavior comported with proper decorum for the courtroom and was going to allow him to proceed pro se. And then the issues occurred on, I think it was November 5th, the first day of trial. And Mr. Donis was trying to explain why he had endorsed certain witnesses he wanted to call. And I think one of them was the psychiatrist who did the psych eval. And basically he was cut off from explaining where he wanted to go with that. And one thing led to another and the judge rescinded the decision and let him go pro se. And it's our position that his behavior was not to the extreme level that was articulated in People versus Cohn. People versus Cohn, I would submit, set the benchmark for behavior, which is necessary before a trial judge can revoke an order allowing a defendant to go pro se.
Pardon me for interrupting if I'm Mr. Marquez. isn't the court entitled to look at the defendant's, for want of a better phrase, whole body of work here in making a decision like that?
Yes and no, Your Honor, and I say that, I'm not trying to evade the question, but I think that that can certainly be a consideration, but I think that there was a break between Mr. Donis's behavior early on and his behavior at the time of the initial trial setting, that being the end of October, beginning of November of 2007.
Well, in the course of this case, he gets held in contempt, if I remember correctly, at least once.
Yes, sir. I think it was more than once.
Yeah. He makes inappropriate comments about the judge's grandchild. He threatens defense counsel's daughter with divine retribution. And he repeatedly refuses to answer the court's question. Indeed, during the hearing in which he finally is allowed to go pro se, I believe the court had to ask him approximately 10 times for an answer. And then his conduct on the day when the court finally said, well, under Cohen, this is what I think I've got to do, was consistent with that obstreperous nature. Am I misreading the record?
I think the facts that you've recited, Judge, are accurate, but I think that the behavior of the defendant at these proceedings was not of the same caliber as it was in Cohn. I think that I don't understand the comment about the trial judge's grandchild, because I believe the trial judge said on the record she didn't have a grandchild, but it just didn't make a lot of sense.
Well, that was right with the comment about divine retribution to defense counsel's child, right?
I think that was around then, yes, sir.
Yeah.
I see I'm already going into my 5 minutes I reserved, so what I'd like to do if I
could... You now have 8 minutes and 57 seconds, according to the clock that I'm looking at.
I just saw the eight, and I thought that that's what I had used up. I have eight left.
Yes, sir.
That's a relief. I don't know if I've answered your question there, Judge.
Please go ahead with your argument, Mr. Borquist. I'm sorry to have interrupted you.
Well, the other point I wanted to make on that issue, Your Honors, is that even if Mr. Donis's behavior were found to be of the caliber of inappropriate behavior in the Cohn case, there was an alternative, and that's the judge could have allowed him to participate by teleconferencing. And this was 10 years ago, I believe. Excuse me, this was only in 2008. It was 3 years ago. But I know that teleconferencing was available 10 years ago, because I'm working on another case where Judge Munch offered that to a defendant in 2000. So the technology existed. In the Cohn case, the Court of Appeals even referenced that as an alternative, where a defendant's behavior is so obstreperous that the defendant cannot remain in the courtroom. That's an alternative that the trial judge has available to use in order to protect the defendant's right to go pro se, while at the same time maintaining proper decorum in the courtroom. Got a couple of minutes left. If there are any questions on that issue, I want to move on to the next. Okay. The next issue I wanted to talk about has to do with the first-degree kidnapping count, and that has to do with the issue of the movement of Mr. Bullock, the complaining witness, from one place to another. And basically, there were two movements in this case. There was the movement from the garage into the study, and then there was the movement from the study out to the front door of the house. And defense counsel had requested that the court order the people to make an election as to which of those two movements was provided the factual basis for the kidnapping charge, the first degree kidnapping charge, whether it was from the garage to the study or study to the front door, because they're logically inconsistent in that in order to maintain the first degree kidnapping charge, that the people would have to show that the victim was moved from one location to another location where the movement increased the risk of harm to the victim in some substantial way. They both can't be the same. In other words, movement from the garage to the study or from the study to the front door, both can't be at placing the victim in an increased risk of harm. And defense counsel...
Pardon me again, Mr. Borquist, I'm sorry, but isn't it an increased risk of harm based upon what they said that they wanted to do when they got outside? They wanted to put him in the car. they wanted him to go with them. And of course, as you know, bad things can happen in that circumstance. Taking him from the garage inside increased his risk, and removing him from the location may have increased his risk even more.
Those are two different ways in which the risk was increased, Your Honor. That's the point I think trial counsel was trying to make. Yes, bad things can happen when you move him from the garage into the study because it's a more secluded location. But moving him from the study out to the car and then having him take them to where the Explorer had been taken after it was repossessed, arguably that was less of a risk. In other words, it was a less dangerous location.
Isn't this all of a piece, though? I mean, we're talking a matter of moments among these different movements. Isn't this too small to parse into different elections?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. We don't believe that they're too small. It's either there was an increase in risk moving from the garage into the study or from the study to the front door and outside.
So are you saying that two separate kidnapping offenses were conceivably committed?
No, Your Honor.
Well, you don't have to elect as far as what evidence supports a single offense. You have to elect as far as two different offenses. Would you disagree with that?
I think that where there's evidence to support two different manners in which the kidnapping offense could be the kidnapping offense, not the kidnapping offenses, but the kidnapping offense could be committed, I think it was incumbent on the people to elect one or the other.
We have 4 minutes and 19 seconds remaining, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I rely on what's in the brief for the third issue, which I ran out of time and was unable to address.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer L. Ward, number 38342, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this action. A brief outline of where I'm going to go today. I'm going to start with the right to proceed pro se, and then I'll proceed on to the unanimity instruction. When I'm talking about the right to proceed pro se, there will be a small discussion about the preliminary hearing, but that's in the context of why defendant was so upset at certain points during his proceedings. Other than that, I'll rest on my briefs on the other issues, as counsel did. The right to self-representation is not absolute, and the trial court did a very good job of outlining the conduct that Mr. Donis participated in that in the end, sorry, I'm a little stuttery today. The trial court did a very good job at outlining Mr. Donis's conduct, and the repercussions of that conduct was that he lost his right to self-representation. Now, Judge Bernard, you asked a question as to whether the trial court could look at Mr. Donis's whole body of work, as you put it. And I would assert that the trial court can. But indeed, in this case, the trial court need not look past November 2nd and November 5th for enough disruption in the courtroom to justify appointment of counsel. On those 2 days, and I'll quote the record just briefly, Mr. Donis said, "I refuse to participate." He turned his back on the court one time on each day for two total times that he turned his back on the court. He said, "I will not be a clown in your circus. I won't partake in these proceedings. You need to recuse yourself. I refuse to go forward." All that is sufficient to be obstructionist and to stop the flow of his judicial proceedings. And that was sufficient to appoint counsel. Unless the court has any questions, I'll move on to the second point. The kidnapping. In my brief, I outlined where this objection came up, and it was actually during a motion for judgment of acquittal. And it was more of a sufficiency of the evidence argument. If you look at the record, you know, the defense counsel says the evidence isn't sufficient. we'd like the people to elect. When the trial court didn't order the people to elect, obviously it was rejecting that argument. And the trial court found that the evidence was sufficient for everyone to carry on. During jury instructions, the only request for unanimity instruction was as to the weapon that was used during the altercation with the victim. And as I stated in my brief, you can't put the court on notice of a unanimity instruction you want by doing a sufficiency of the evidence objection during your judgment of acquittal. It doesn't work. You have to put the court on notice. So there was no unanimity issue here. And it was certainly, it wasn't preserved. And the sufficiency of the evidence is waived because it wasn't raised here in this court. Does the court have any questions about that? Can I answer any other questions for the court? Then the people. Then if there are no more questions, I'll rest on my briefs, and I would request this court to affirm the judgment. Thank you very much.
Quiz?
Yes, I'll be very, very brief, Your Honors. On the issue of the kidnapping and the issue of whether there was a request for a unanimity instruction, there was not a request for a unanimity instruction. I think we conceded that, if not in the opening brief, I think it may have been in the reply brief. And if it isn't, I'm conceding that right now.
It was in your brief, okay. Counsel. I recall seeing it.
Okay. The one thing that was done, however, Your Honors, is on July 29th, 2008, defense counsel did ask, and it's on page 90-91 of the transcript, did request that the people be ordered to make an election. And I think that at least adequately preserves that part of the issue. There were two ways this could have been dealt with, the kidnapping issue, either requiring the people to make an election, which was preserved, or requesting a unanimity instruction, which was not. So I think, I don't know if that clears it up, but that's all I've got to add on that. Unless there are any other questions. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Borquist, thank you to both counsel for your arguments. We very much appreciate them. The case will stand submitted and